Okay, so yesterday, so today we continue our discussion about the Z2 quantum lattice gauge theory. So we saw that we define it on a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions. In which we place the spins on the bonds, so that our total Hilbert space, if this is a L times L lattice, is a C square tensor to N, to L square, sorry. And we define the gauge transformation based at the site N as the product of sigma x around the edges that come out from any site, and the gauge invariant Hilbert space is the set of states that respect the gauge invariants. And then we define our gauge invariant quantities that are the plaquette operators. So sigma z around the plaquette. And our z2 Hamiltonian is minus j, the sum over all the BPs, minus g, the sum over all sigma x's. Because also this is a gauge invariant operator, of course. So we saw that in the limit of G very large, we have a Bohring paramagnet. It's just a paramagnet with decaying correlation functions and no order parameter. And in the limit G equals zero, we found that we have a gap that is equal to 4J, right? And we saw that we have a degeneracy that is equal to 4, right? And if you remember where this degeneracy comes from the fact that if I take one ground state and then I apply onto this ground state this non-contractible loop operator means that I flip all these spins. I obtain, so this operator commutes with the Hamiltonian. So I stay in the ground space, but I obtain another state that is orthogonal to the first one. And the same if I do this. Okay, so we have four states because I can apply, I can start from one, I can apply none of them, I have the first state, then I can apply this, I have the second state, or I can apply this, I have the third one, or I can apply both and I have the fourth one. They're all orthogonal. Okay? So you can repeat this construction, the same construction, on a any Riemann surface, okay? So a Riemann surface is just a surface with without boundary. Yeah? No, you have to speak louder.
Here we have periodic boundary conditions on this lattice, so where would higher genus surfaces come from? How would
you do something like this. So you take something with, for instance, with two holes. So genus is two. Two is the number of holes in a Riemann surface. And so you know that you cannot have the same number of stars of things like this and of plaquettes when the genus is greater than one. So this means that it would not be a square lattice, okay? So you would have some more complicated lattice, you know, and the exact shape that you have depends on what Riemann surface you wrap it around. But no matter, so these properties are not properties of the square lattice. So you see that if I define my star operators here and my plaquette operators here, they still commute.
But
it's still periodic boundary conditions, but you would get a different genus. But because of that, you would have the same constraints, that the product of the A's is 1 and the product of the B's is 1. So everything would be the same, only you have more holes. This only you have more holes means that now you have more non-contractible operators. Right? For every hole, you have a pair. Right? Okay. And for every pair, you have a four-dimensional algebra, right? So the degeneracy in general is 2 to the 2g, because you have two copies of the algebra, of the Pauli algebra, for every hole that you have in the Riemann surface. If I do it on the sphere, I have no degeneracy, because the genus is 0. So you see that the topology of your system is manifest in the degeneracy of the ground state. Okay, so all this is true at g equals 0. And now we understand that we have two phases anyway, right? So because there must be a quantum phase transition in between for two reasons. First of all, because I changed the degeneracy. Second, because we already know from the classical case that if we consider the Wilson loops, so I take any loop, contractible loop C, and I define WC as the product of sigma z around C. So it's my gauge invariant quantities. Okay? So we know that for small g, this is e to the minus something times C. Whereas for large g, we have e to the minus something else, the area enclosed by C. So how do we know that? Because this theory is the quantum version of the Ising lattice gauge theory in 3D. So if you do the quantum classical mapping, that we didn't show explicitly, but it is the same procedure, you see, so that this mapping works. So those calculations that we saw, we can import them. So these two behaviors cannot be connected analytically. So it means that there is a transition in between, a quantum phase transition. So there are two phases. But now I would like to know, is this degeneracy a property of the whole phase? Or as soon as I introduce this as a perturbation, I open a gap, okay? So between the four line states, I open a gap. So this question is very non-trivial. For instance, if you consider the classical, even two-dimensional Ising theory, not the gauge theory, the Ising model in 2D, which has a degeneracy, This, as soon as you add a magnetic field, this degeneracy split. And the splitting is equal to the strength of G. So you know from perturbation theory that when you have a degeneracy, this degeneracy is conserved only if your perturbation has the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So that's why if you break the symmetry, then you open a gap. It's the same thing. So when one studies perturbation theory, should understand that this is really what we're talking about. How the interplay between the symmetry of the Hamiltonian and the perturbations resolves or not this degeneracy. So here we have a perturbation that, so when we switch on this external magnetic field, well, this manifestly respects the gauge structure. So I should not say gauge symmetry, right? But it commutes with the Hamiltonian. And our question is, can we hope that this means that the degeneracy is not split? And the answer is yes. But the initial intuition that is because of the symmetry is wrong. So I will show you why the degeneracy is not split, but it is not because of symmetry. Okay, so this is very important. And at the end of this lesson, we will see that this thing has, when we go beyond the gauge theory, so we can get rid of any symmetry at all, then we'll see this has very profound consequences. Okay, so I want to see if this degeneracy between these four states splits when I introduce this as a perturbation. So as a perturbation, I just mean that G is kind of much smaller than J, okay? But it actually does not need to be very, very, very much smaller. Anyway, so let's say much smaller to be sure. So from perturbation theory, you know that a splitting can only appear if your perturbation at some order in perturbation theory has non-vanishing matrix elements between two states that are degenerate. If your perturbation has the same symmetry as the Hamiltonian, then you cannot couple these states at the first order, say, in perturbation theory. But maybe at some order it breaks this symmetry. And if you cannot connect them, then there can be no splitting. Because then the splitting comes from the diagonalization of this operator. But if the operator is zero in that subspace, if all the matrix elements are zero, there is no, you know, you cannot get different eigenvalues from the null operator. Okay. So this is ordinary perturbation theory, right? Okay, so let's see. I take my ground state 0, 0. Remember, by 0, 0 means that I start from ground state, for instance, the one that I obtain. Okay, I start from some ground state, and then I do not apply any of these two. Okay, so let me call this one 0, 0, or psi 0, 0. And then I put minus g. And for instance, psi 0, 1. And this is identically 0. Why? Can you tell me why? So why the first order in perturbation theory I cannot do anything?
Because
Good try, but the gauge symmetry is A that contains X and actually commutes with this one. So it's not the Elitzur theorem. This, yeah. So this works for sigma z, but not for that. So when we say that the algebra of the ground space is the algebra of these loops, this means that the only way to connect these states is if there are operators that contain these loops. There is no way of connecting them with something that does not contain one of those loops. Right? Those are the operators that move you in that ground state. Otherwise, these operators would not let you establish a basis in the ground space. But these operators have a support that's L, right? These operators have a support that is 1, so they cannot connect. At the second order in perturbation theory, you would have something like this. And it would still be true that it's 0. However, at the L order in perturbation theory, some combinations, you know, in this, when I express this power, at some point, this operator will appear at the L order in perturbation theory, and I can finally split the degeneracy. So, and what is the splitting like? It's something like this. So my small delta A, something like this, where this is a number smaller than 1 because of this. So this goes like e to the minus L. So the splitting is exponentially small, and in the thermodynamic limit is 0. So in the thermodynamic limit, there is no splitting. So this degeneracy is robust. Okay. So this means that once we are in one of these ground states, no matter if we switch on this field, so of course, if I switch on this field, I might tunnel to some excited states. But I cannot tunnel to the other ground states. So effectively, I don't see the presence of the other ground states. So you remember that we proved the Lieb-Mathis-Schütz theorem that says if the ground state is unique, then the correlation functions have to decay exponentially. And somehow what I'm saying is that this is an argument to say that the ground state, it is as if it was unique. But I'm waving my hands, right? So we want to prove it rigorously, and there is a way to prove it rigorously. So there are two ways of proving it rigorously. First of all, you can prove this statement in general, that if there are no matrix element in your perturbation between the states, then the Lieb-Mathis-Schütz theorem applies. Or I can do, so this is a complicated theorem. Or in this case, I can do something simpler, which shows again the power of duality arguments. Okay, so now we'll do a duality mapping, just like we did with the Ising model. And with the Ising model, with the quantum Ising model, we saw that that is a self-dual. Now we will not find that this model is self-dual, okay? But the dual model is very interesting. And we can derive things from the dual model. So now let me redraw my lattice. So duality means that I go to the dual lattice, right? So if this is the original lattice, my new nodes, my new vertices, are the center of the plaquettes. So P. Okay? And I want to define new variables on P. I will call them mu1 and mu2. Sorry, mu3, because I like 1 and 3, because it reminds me of x and z. Okay, so mu1 of P is very easy. I identify it with BP. So BP is an operator on P, which is what it is. It's this one. And I call this variable mu1. So now you remember that in the Ising model, we looked for something that was like a string operator. That was in 1D, though. Okay? So let me define some origin of the lattice. Some origin here and some origin here. And I can call and define this string, the string that goes from the origin to P in the x direction, and the same and the other string that goes from the origin to P in the y direction. And this string carries x. Just like, remember, our string when we did the first duality thing was the same, but there we were in 1D, so we didn't have two directions. So I call this string mu3 of P, because it ends on P, so it's the product of all the spins from the origin to P of sigma x L, and let me put another index nu that just reminds me in what directions. So nu has two values, that is either x or y. So means that I'm moving in this direction or in this direction. So in principle, also this origin is labeled by nu because it's a different origin if I move in one direction or the other direction. So, but apart from this cumbersome notation, because I need to take care of two directions, it's the same string operator than before. Is it clear? So you see that, of course, they both square to the identity. And on the same P, they anti-commute. Do you see that? So this is x, x, x. This is here z, 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 z. They only have one spin as a common support, where they realize x and z, so they anti-commute. Oh, so this is the algebra of a spin one half, still the same trick. So these are spin variables. So now let's see how this Hamiltonian maps in the new variables. Okay, so before I do that, I need to fix something in my Hilbert space. Because you remember, my Hilbert space is labeled not only by the BPs, but also by these Z1 and Z2. But so let me fix myself in the sector, say, 0, 0. Let me decide where I am. I can do that because I already know that when I switch on the perturbation, I will stay there because we have just shown that I cannot connect them. So that's how I use this thing. Okay. So the only variables that I'm mapping are the BP. I don't need to wonder what happens to the topological degrees of freedom because I fix the sector. Okay. So with this precision, how does this map? So HZ2 goes into, okay, minus J, the sum over P of mu1, and then you see, just a second, that sigma x on a, say, this spin is equal to the string to up to P times the string up to P plus 1. Because they overlap for all the spins and they square to the identity, and then I'm left with only one sigma x. So this becomes the sum over mu3 P, mu3 P plus, okay, so this is in plus 1 in the x direction. So it's plus x. If I do it in this other way, because I also have these ones, I also have these spins, right? The sigma x on the horizontal spins, they couple P, P plus y. So I can write P plus nu here, and have the sum here over all the P and the nu, so where nu is x and y. And the coupling G. And here you see that this is the quantumizing model in two spatial dimensions. Wow. Who had a question before I go ahead? Yeah. Just
defining U3, do you say that you define it as a product of all sigma x on the x direction times the ones on the y direction?
Or no. It is either I move in this way, so in this when I move horizontally, I say that nu has the value x, or I start from this other line and then move vertically up, and then I say that nu has the value y. So it's a different mu. Yeah, I should very good, thanks. So mu3 as this. And somehow, which mu3 I'm talking about is implicit in this notation.
When you say the spin operator is anti-commute, like mu1 has two spin operators that end up.
Yes. And they do the same thing. Yeah. Okay. So we are interested. So this is a quantumizing model in 2D. And we are interested in what happens at small g. Large J, right? Because we want to understand, we already know our correlation functions when G is very large. It's the Bohrian paramagnet. I want now to know my correlation functions when J is large. And I compute them in here. And these are, we see that now the correlation functions that I can compute are So when J is large, this is the Bohrian paramagnet. Okay? So when I compute these correlation functions, mu3 at P, mu3 at P prime, these correlation functions in this model, they decay exponentially. Okay? Just look at this as the Ising model. All right, but who is mu3?
So mu3 is
this string. So I have xxx up to p times xxxx up to p prime. So I have this correlation function. So the correlation function of all these x's. So this one decays exponentially. And actually, one can prove that if this one decays exponentially, also the two-point correlation function decays exponentially. OK. So there are some other interesting properties of the gauge theory, but I will not show them in the gauge theory because they are, we can show them in a more general model. So it's finally whereas the mapping is for the gauge theory. Okay, but it's time now to abandon the gauge theory and to find a more physical model, a spin model. So in which I start from my lattice, my degrees of freedom are the spins on the lattice, and my Hilbert space is H dot. Because you see this, who, in what way this gauge structure is realized in nature? Why we wouldn't be able, why nature would say that these spins are not physical? I mean, either some gauge principle is fundamental, or it's not fundamental. If it's not fundamental, then you can violate it. It's just a mathematical game to say, oh, the physical degrees of freedom are those such that a psi is equal to psi, but I required it as a postulate, but there is no reason why this should be realized in nature. Moreover, if it were realized in nature, it would be very weird because we saw that our Hilbert space becomes very non-local because it's the product of local Hilbert spaces that are the Plaquette Hilbert spaces times these two large loops that are very non-local, and we don't like that. But actually, the gauge structure can be emergent. And in a very easy way, actually. So what we do now is that we work on the total Hilbert space. So all spin configurations are basis states and they're physical. So we do not have a gauge structure, okay? But now my Hamiltonian, let me call it TC, because this model is called the toric code. It was invented by Kitaev now, like 17 years ago or something like that, is a simple variation. So let me be, first of all, without external magnetic field. It's just this. Minus U minus J. So now these are operators, right? These are operators that can have some expectation value that can be minus one. I am not restricting myself to the space, Hilbert space, where the A's have a value plus one. And I'm just, and I can put it in the Hamiltonian, and I put it in the Hamiltonian, and I say my energy is the sum of, I get an energy to U every time I buy your A is equal minus one, and energy to J every time B is equal minus one. So just like as before, I was saying that, oh, this plus one, I say no vortex. And minus one, I say vortex. Now I have these other things. When this is plus one, I say no charge. And when this is minus one, I say charge. So I have, this is a z to vortex, this is a z to charge, that has only two possible values, plus one and minus one. So this is just jargon, right? Just means what I said. But now let's decide that U is much larger than J. Much, much larger than J. Notice also that as before, because these are the same operators than before, they commute. So these are good quantum numbers, right? So this means that the basis in my Hilbert space, that is the full Hilbert space, so it's 2L square, is this one. A1, A, L square minus 1, because remember, I have a constraint here as well. B1, B, L square minus 1, and again, my Z1 and Z2. So these are L square degrees of freedom, L square new spins, and or I could use the basis of the spins, right? I1, I, L square. So I am in the full Hilbert space. They both are good bases in my Hilbert space. This basis is non-local because it contains these two, and this one is local. But now this is a choice of basis. This is somehow more physical. But this basis, why it's good? Because it's also the basis in which the Hamiltonian is diagonal. You see, these are the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So the ground state is the state where all these are plus one, and these are whatever, so it's fourfold degenerate as before, as in the gauge theory. So the ground state energy is minus L square U plus J. And then every time I put a charge, I get an energy plus 2U. But actually, I can only put even number of charges. Remember, the even number of charges comes from this constraint. So even number of charges in even number of vortices. And every time I put a vortex, I have an energy 4J, because I have to put 2. So 2J per vortex. So if this is much, much larger than J, okay, then our spectrum is like this. I have my fourfold degeneracy. Then I have my gap is 4J. Then I have a band of states that have an energy of order J. And then I have another band of states that have an energy order U. So these are the states that I get when I put charges, and these are the states that I get when I put vortices. I'm just saying the charges have much more energy than the vortices.
Okay, change eigenvalues of operator B, okay? Then, okay, so we increase energy by a factor, okay, of, as you are saying, 4G, okay? But in this band, okay, we have a number of levels for the L squared, okay?
Yes.
So does it mean that to realize this picture, U has to be bigger than G
L squared? Yeah. Bigger than L. So to realize this picture, U must be bigger than L squared J to really completely separate the two bands. Okay, but bear with me, okay? Let me see the thermodynamic limit in the end. So now look at, now believe this picture the way it is, okay? We have for some finite system and it's like this. Now you see that all these low-lying energy states, and later if I want to do the thermodynamic limit, maybe I can also restrict a little bit how many vortices I put. So I would define some threshold. Okay. I would say, okay, this is my low energy sector. They must have A equal plus 1. They must only be linear combinations of vectors that have A plus 1, otherwise I would jump up here. Okay, so this means that the low energy sector, and for sure the ground state, no matter, actually the ground state, even if U is equal J, is the same ground state than the gauge theory. And at low energies, I still have the gauge theory. So all we said about the ground state is also valid now, because the ground state is the same. And now we want to see what the ground state looks like in the spins degrees of freedom. So we know what it looks like in these particle degrees of freedom. It looks like there are no particles. The ground state is the vacuum of the charges and of the vortices. But what does it look like as spins degrees of freedom? This is what we want to know. So now the ground state, so the ground space, is this manifold, because it's fourfold degenerate, are all the states in the Hilbert space, that is the total one, such that, as I said, all A are 1 and all B are 1. So such that A psi is equal psi is equal B psi for every n and p. So to find this ground state, we have to do our projection, right? But now we have to project not only onto these constraints, but also onto these constraints. So how do we do that? I do a trick. Let me start from a reference state, because I can do that. So let me start from the state at 0, that by definition for me is all spins up. This is very convenient because BP on 0 is already 0 for every P. So this state already obeys, it's already a state on the hypersurface where all these constraints are respected. Okay, so now what I do, I take my, remember the projector onto these constraints? So my projector onto these constraints was the product of 1 plus A of n over 2, the product of all of them. And so a state, so this state, P0, which is equal to the product of 1 plus AN over 2, is a state in the ground state. Sorry, 0. This is a state in the ground state, right? It's one of the 4. But you know how to find the other 4, the other 3. You just take this one, that by definition I can call it psi 0, 0. I can say, this is the state where I didn't apply any loop operators, and then you apply your loop operator, so you get the other 4, the other 3. So you get all 4 of them. So let's see what this one looks like. As we said, we have some normalization, and this is the sum over the identity plus over all the possible AN that were my previous gauge transformations. Now they are not gauge transformations. They are real transformations on the spin configurations, plus the product over all the possible pairs, and so on and so forth. Now, let me define G, the group that is generated by all the products of the A operators. So the notation is this. So this is just all the possible products of the A operators. And every time you take a set in which you can define a multiplication, you take all the possible products, this is a group. Okay, so this is a group. And let me call G, small g, the elements of this group. So you can see that I can write this as the sum of these things. And just as a convenient notation, oh, okay, so first of all, now we know what is the normalization. It's 1 over the square root of the number of elements that are in the group. And what is this number of elements? Since these objects square to the identity, so I cannot multiply them twice and get a new one, then it's easy to see that this is 2 to the L squared minus 1. For more complicated groups, it's more complicated to find this, the order of the group. But in this case, it's this one. As a convenient notation, G applied to 0, I just call it ket G. So this is 1 over square root of the order of G, the sum of this G. So the ground state is the superposition of something. And it's the superposition of something with all equal amplitudes. So it's the uniform superposition of some objects. And what are these objects? These are, by definition, products of A operators. So what is a one? So let me show the typical element in this superposition. It's the sum product of A operators, right? So imagine that I have the the trivial product, you know, one A operator. Okay? So one A operator means that I am applying this operator here. As we saw, I think, last time, flipping these spins is the same. You could imagine that I have some Wilson loop on the dual lattice. You see, a cross on the dual lattice becomes a plaquette. So the simplest product is when you have only the product, you know, you have only these objects here. Is something like this. So I have a product of two of them is something like this. If some of them are contiguous, the interior cancels, you remember? So you have something like this. I have to draw it on the dual lattice. So I could as well write that my ground state my psi 0,0 is equal to this guy times the sum of all loop configurations. By loop configurations, I mean the spin configurations, which all the spins are up, but those that are intersected by loop are minus one, are down. So the ground state of this model is a loop gas, where all the loops have the same amplitude. And the other ground state are the same loop gas to which I have added a non-contractible loop. So psi 0,1, as we said, is obtained by psi 0,0 by doing x around a non-contractible loop. And psi 1,0 is this one. And psi 1,1 is this one. So these are the ground states. Now remember that at G equals, so for this Hamiltonian, so these are the four ground states, so that we have a fourfold degeneracy, right? So now let's put a perturbation. But now we are not in the gauge theory anymore. Okay? So now my perturbation, so my Hamiltonian, will be my toric-coed Hamiltonian that only depends on U and J that I don't even mention plus some L V. And all I want from V, lambda V, is that this is the sum of some local operators of diameter R. Now, these operators do not need to be gauge invariant. We are beyond the gauge theory. We are in the full Hilbert space. These are whatever operators you want. You are used to the fact that if you break all the symmetries of a Hamiltonian, then you will resolve the degeneracy. Actually, it's not true. So the example is this one. If I want to break the degeneracy, I must tunnel between psi 0,0 and, say, psi 0,1. And I try to do it at the n order in perturbation theory. And now you see that for the same argument than before, this splitting is different from 0 if and only if, actually not if and only if, if this is different from 0, then it could still be zero if we have some specific form. But if this is different from zero, so at least n times r must be equal to L. Because at this order, in perturbation theory, these objects can have a support that is, it is n times r, right? And so they can have a support L, which means they can contain one of the only operators that can connect different ground states. So this means that the minimum order of perturbation theory in which I can have a splitting is L over R. So the consequence of this is that the splitting and or the tunneling amplitudes, because the two things are closely related, just it's the same thing in two different bases, goes like e to the minus L over R, where R is the locality of my perturbation. So if our perturbation is local, as any good perturbation should be, in the thermodynamic limit, so in any case, this is still an exponential suppression, and there is no splitting. So as a matter of fact, you are stuck in one of the four ground states. Now we don't have that mapping anymore, but because of the Lib-Mathis-Schütz theorem, taking into account the fact that I'm stuck, it is as if the ground state was unique, although I didn't prove this rigorously. I just showed it some examples. But the same conclusion holds. All the correlation functions decay exponentially. So we finally have the promised result. That we were guided to from this study of the structure of correlations in the ground state, we can have systems in which you have a gap and degeneracy, but all the correlation functions decay exponentially. There is no symmetry breaking. Then there is no local order parameter. And every time you measure some magnetization, looks like a paramagnet. The correlations are like a paramagnet, right? They decay exponentially. There is no long-range order. But it's not a paramagnet because it has a degeneracy that is robust. And this is not a trivial thing. And it has more. The excitations over the ground state are not trivial, which I will show in, give me 3 minutes more and I'll show you this thing. Okay, so it looks like a paramagnet every time you look at correlation functions, but it's not a paramagnet. So what about the excitations? So as we said, the excitations are pairs of vortices or pairs of charges. I want to convince you that these objects can be seen as just like we have this string theoretic picture for the ground state. We are saying the ground state is the uniform superposition of all the loops. I want to convince you that also these are string states. In fact, consider the string operator on the dual lattice that carries x. Okay. So by this picture, what I mean is that I take the Wx on the curve gamma that it's an open curve that has n points p and p prime. And I apply it to psi 0, 0. So this is the product of sigma x over all the j's in gamma pp prime. And this is 1 over square root of g, the sum of g in g, g. Verify that this state is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian that has energy for u. But you see it from the picture. This string commutes with all these plaquettes because crosses each of them twice, apart from the two in the endpoints. So the resulting state is the state in which I have minus one in p and p prime. So the graphic proof is actually very powerful, but you can easily do it algebraically. So you just, how you prove that this is an eigenstate? Just apply the Hamiltonian on this state and see what eigenvalue, see that it's an eigenstate and that what is your eigenvalue. It will be E0 plus for u. And similarly, I can have a string on the lattice, a string of z, and I create a pair of quasi-particles like this. Now, these particles are bosons. How do we know that they are bosons? So what does it mean to be a boson or a fermion? Yeah, that's a way. The other way of seeing that is that if you take two such particles and you exchange them, you get a phase plus one. So you get nothing in the case of bosons. So you get a phase minus one for fermions. So how do I exchange them? How do I do that? So imagine that I have a pair of quasi-particles. So a pair of quasi-particles is a string, right, of either type. And now I want to exchange these guys. So what I can do is to apply on the ground state. So, sorry, I can apply on this state a loop operator, because the loop operator, so this is what I should prove you. So I don't have time. Okay. This takes 10 minutes. Okay, so tomorrow, Monday, we start with the proof that these two states are bosons. But I will show you that if I take two of them and I bind them together, so I glue them together, so now these particles, the bound state of a Z2 charge and a Z2 vortex, I can consider it as a new particle. This particle is a fermion. So the Z2 theory has emergent fermions. They are not there to start with. They emerge at low energy. And when we generalize this theory, we will see that every particle can emerge from topological order. So it's not just a paramagnet. OK, thank you. Yeah?
If we had some system that was sort of like our loop gas, is there any way to choose which ground state we end up in of the four?
Yeah, so to choose it, you must be able in the lab to realize one of these operators. So this is admittedly something very hard, but it's not impossible. So there are ways of doing that.
Is there a way to move between ground states by going to an excited state and then decaying to some other ground state?
Very good. Not at zero temperature. So at zero temperature, also the excited part of the spectrum splits in four topological sectors. And this is a very good point. Tomorrow I will show you this, that also the excited part splits, so you can't. Okay.